Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
Adam, on our show today, we'll be talking with Dr. Joanne Jordan, Joseph P. Archie Jr., Professor of Medicine at UNC, about muscles, joints, aches, and related diseases.
This could just apply to
Sounds
me.
Painful.
This may just be my own private consultation today.
Exactly. It'll be good to get some answers for people.
Oh, yeah. I know this is common for lots of folks, but we're also talking about common things in research that matters today, Christy. We're going to be talking about if you have violent tendencies or problems as a teen, is this a can you overcome it as an adult?
And about people overestimating their exercise intensity.
About the red processed meats. Does it matter if you eat those versus the unprocessed meats?
And about sitting too long might increase your cancer risk.
We better get up.
I know. We're sitting right now. We better get up. Okay.
Well, let's talk this first study, Christy. And this I found disturbing, and I'm sure you do as well, which is that youth who have problems, what we might call delinquency, well, does this predict whether or not they're going to have violent death as adults? And I guess the answer is yes.
I know. It's really disturbing. So problems among teenagers like alcohol abuse, selling drugs, or gang involvement were the three big risk factors that predicted a violent death by age 34, according to this study in the journal Pediatrics.
Yeah, this really looked at teens that were, you know, 800 of them between the ages of 1800, right, between 10 and 18 years of age, between 1995 and 1998, and then followed them up 16 years later and found that the death rates for these teens that were involved in these behaviors, like alcohol abuse, you said, selling drugs and gang involvement, was just astronomical. Like the rate of violent death among the females was 5 times higher than females in the general population.
And the rate of violent death was nearly twice as high as U.S. combat troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. So, like, really putting that into perspective, that these teenagers are at very high risk of being murdered or having a violent death with a gun. And highlighting to me that we need to really target the juvenile court system for interventions that might be able to reduce violence. It's obviously complex, but that could be a place to start.
Yeah, 111 of these 1,800 teens had died at follow-up. 68% were murdered, and 91% of these were murdered committed with a gun. So some of the conversations we've had, Christy, some of my own research that we've been doing to look at ways of reducing gun violence, it's critical. These things are linked. But, you know, these are risk factors. We should identify them, and let's start doing more research and intervene. I think everyone can agree on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's hard to move from such a shocking starter, but let's move on to people overestimating exercise intensity. This is a fun study to me.
It's a fun study, but it's also an important issue that maybe we don't talk about as much, because this was in the journal PLOS One, PLOS One. It's an open access journal, which means people can publish in it more freely, but very good journal. And they looked at 129 adults who really didn't do much physical activity, who were between the ages of 18 and 64, and kind of asked them, did they really know what light physical activity, what was moderate, and what was vigorous? Could they identify that? Maybe they didn't, and maybe they overestimated how much activity they were getting.
Exactly. And they even had some lessons about what constituted, what does it mean to have light versus moderate versus vigorous exercise intensity. But then after that, they were put onto a treadmill and told to adjust it to be at basically light, and then adjust it to be moderate, and then adjust it to be vigorous exercise for them. And it was kind of sad to find out that they underestimated what they were doing, or they overestimated what they were doing.
Right. They could estimate what the light physical activity
was. Everybody could figure that out slowly.
I can lift 5 pounds, but maybe I can't lift 25 pounds. Maybe I can't lift 50 pounds here. And I know this with physical activity, that when I'm just kind of running on my own, you know, I can do that 9.5 minute mile pace. But when I'm running with someone who does 8.5 minute miles, I could do it, but I don't do it on my own. So sometimes maybe getting pushed. I wonder if having a friend that you can exercise with could push you to maybe understand better, you know, or do you both just go to the light activity? Because the benefit is from a little bit more exercise, not less.
Right. And granted, this was a group of people who don't exercise very much. So you probably wouldn't fall in that category, Adam, thankfully.
Not last week. Maybe next week.
But it does highlight to all of us that we probably should be pushing ourselves a little bit more than we are.
Yeah, we should ask our great reference librarians at the University of North Carolina Health Sciences Library to put some information up about target heart rate, because there is ways of understanding how you can get a higher heart rate and what that mm-hmm. target is based upon your exercise level. Mm-hmm.
Okay, now we're talking about hot dogs and salami for you men out there. Apparently, steaks might be safer for your heart than eating hot dogs and salami and processed meats.
Yeah, and I think this is something that we've talked about a little bit over the years, Christy, where we look at processed meats, things that are also smoked and cured, and the things that have preservative in them, sometimes with salt or nitrates. And these smoked and the grilled meats, they can also contain these hydrocarbons, which can be cancer-causing. And in this particular study, did they cause heart failure or associated with heart failure or other heart problems?
Yeah. So thinking about heart failure, it's a major problem, especially in America. And in this study, as they tracked people, and men in particular, and there was 37,000 men ages 45 to 79.
Swedish men.
Exactly.
Put that out there.
Who had no history of heart failure, heart disease, or cancer, and then got information about their diet and followed them over time. They found a real association between the amount of processed red meats that the men ate with a risk of heart failure and heart failure death.
Yeah, 2 to 3 slices of a processed meat, ham or bacon, had a 28% higher risk of heart failure and a 2 times risk from heart failure compared to those who ate less than 1 ounce of this processed meat daily. Now, this is not a cause and effect, and we should be really clear mm-hmm. that these things are only associations, and there could be lots of other factors, but it's a good study. It was published in Circulation, Heart Failure, a very prominent cardiac journal, and I think it should be taken seriously to think about reducing the processed meats in favor of unprocessed meats.
Agreed. I mean, if you have the option, try to choose something that you're cooking yourself and that's more fresh.
And you can still enjoy it.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
Speaking of enjoyment, let's talk about this last particular research that matters, which is
sitting.
How much we enjoy sitting versus getting up and doing activity. We know doing activity is good for you, but can sitting be higher cancer risk in and of itself?
Okay. So this was a study that was one of those review studies where they looked at 43 studies that had already been done to try to pool them together that included over 4 million study participants and almost 70,000 different cancer causes to try to figure out a relationship between sedentary behavior or the number of hours we spend sitting either in front of the TV or at work with getting cancer.
This was in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, and they did find that for an additional 2 hours of sedentary sitting behavior, there was an 8% higher chance of or increase in colon cancer risk, a 10% increase in cancer of the uterus, and a 6% increase in lung cancer. Now, that doesn't sound like maybe a lot, but boy, if I know that that's increasing my risk, I think I'm going to get up a little bit more often because,
yeah.
Boy, that doesn't seem that difficult compared to just staying sitting.
It does point out that there are other behaviors that can increase your risk of cancer, like drinking and smoking and being obese and having a genetic predisposition or something that's passed down in your DNA from your family. But getting up, I mean, and sedentary behavior is something that we can change. So something to think about and quit smoking.
All good ideas. And we've had some really good chance today, Christy, to talk about some important research that matters. But we're going to take a short break. And when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Joanne Jordan, Joseph Archie Professor of Medicine at the University of North Carolina, about muscles, joints, aches, and related diseases. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's No. 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Joanne Jordan, Joseph P. Archie Professor of Medicine at the University of North Carolina, about muscles, joints, aches, and related diseases.
Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Jordan.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
You know, what sparked your interest in rheumatology? And probably for all of us, you should define for us, what is rheumatology?
So rheumatology is really the study of diseases, people who have diseases that include any kinds of arthritis, any kinds of muscle disorders, the musculoskeletal system, and what we call connective tissue diseases. And those are things that really are usually autoimmune in nature. That is, your immune system fights against your own body. I got interested in this when I was a medical student and happened to be taking a rotation in rheumatology, and was very inspired by the people who were there teaching me, but also by the very broad range of different types of conditions that the patients who were on the service had.
You know, where does the word rheumatology? I mean, that word itself, I know it's joints and muscles, but we had rheumatism. People, would say that. But where did the word come from? Do you have any?
It does have to do with that sort of rheum, which is sort of, the humors in your blood and those sorts of things. I mean, it tends to be.
So this is an ancient term, and these are ancient diseases. You know, when we think of rheumatology, I think you picked the perfect field. You picked a field in which everyone just about seems like gets some sort of arthritis. Is it a universal phenomenon that goes across culture and societies, men and women?
Well, arthritis or musculoskeletal conditions really are the leading cause of disability in this country as well as around the globe. But it doesn't mean that everybody gets them.
Okay.
There are certain types of arthritis, osteoarthritis in particular, which is the most common kind. And we tend to see a lot of that. And that's the one that people tend to think about as, everybody gets this. They just live long enough, everybody will get this. And that's actually not true. It's not just the wear and tear. We try to get away from that concept of wear and tear. Your joints sort of wear out. As you get older, your joints are really a little bit less able to take an insult, so to speak, than they would be if you were younger. But they're still normal joints. Older people with normal joints are not the same as having osteoarthritis.
And osteoarthritis is often linked to weight, but yet rheumatoid arthritis is something different. Help us understand the difference for our listeners, because that one can be a little more scary for people, I think.
Yes. So rheumatoid arthritis is one of those autoimmune conditions, which is your body makes antibodies against itself. So you actually produce molecules that go into the lining of the joint and attack your own self. This typically is the scary kind, as we say, but over the last 10 to 15 years, dramatic changes have happened in how we manage rheumatoid arthritis. Osteoarthritis, on the other hand, is one that in women in particular around the time of menopause, frequently women will develop some knobby changes in their fingers, and that tends to set them up for the possibility of developing osteoarthritis elsewhere, so in the knees and the hips. And you're right, it tends to be associated with people who gain a lot of weight or people who have a lot of weight, particularly for the knees. I had a patient not too long ago who was able to actually differentiate itself. So differentiate the two types of arthritis, I mean. She had osteoarthritis in her hands, as many, many women do, and she was in her 60s. And one day, or after several weeks, she started noticing that something was clearly different. And the thing that was different was that she had different joints in her hands that got involved. And she also noticed that she had significant morning stiffness. And this is one of the key things that we use to differentiate whether somebody has veered off the course of just having osteoarthritis, which can be significant in and of itself, but also develop rheumatoid arthritis on top of that. So osteoarthritis tends to happen in the joints out in the fingers. And this particular woman noticed that the joints, sort of your knuckles, right where your fingers connect, were getting very swollen and squishy, and you could actually feel a lot of swelling in there that was soft tissues. And morning stiffness, where she would wake up and it would take her 3 or 4 hours to be able to get her hands to really loosen up.
So luckily, what could you do for her?
Luckily, she was smart enough to come in and say something's not right. But a lot of times, if people don't make that connection, they may get sort of thought about, oh, you know, it's just your arthritis. It's just your arthritis, without making that differentiation.
So let's take a step back for a second. I mean, you see common diseases, you see scary diseases. You see the lupus cases and the rare autoimmune cases and these bad arthritis, these deforming arthritis. But you see these common things like the osteoarthritis and as well as like fibromyalgia, where all the muscles and joints kind of hurt. How do you advise patients, family members, you might, who ask you, when do they need to see a rheumatologist? When should they even go see their primary care doctor to talk about joint pain?
Well, that's a really important point that you bring up, because many times, again, as people get older, they may think that it's normal to have joint pain, or that nothing is amiss, or that there's nothing that can be done about it. So to even get back to Christy's point, too, about what would be done differently, clearly if someone has rheumatoid arthritis and we're able to show that, that is treated very differently from osteoarthritis right now. So whereas we don't usually use cortisone or prednisone in osteoarthritis, we do in rheumatoid arthritis sometimes. We'll use things like methotrexate and some of the newer biologics. And that's also sometimes being used in lupus and some of these other things. I think if you're noticing that your question about when should you talk to your doctor about it is an important one, because many times people don't. And so I think if you're starting to notice pain, particularly when you move around and use that joint, but in addition, if you're noticing pain or discomfort when you have that joint at rest, if it's keeping you up at night, or if it's preventing you from being able to do what you need to do. If you notice a lot of redness or a lot of swelling, that would be clearly a cause to have someone take a look at it and see. The two most common causes of really a lot of redness and swelling of the joint is going to be something based on crystals like gout, or calcium crystals can also do that. And sometimes, very rarely, it could be an infection in the joint. So those would be really important times to see your doctor.
And I would imagine you have to guide patients through symptoms that may not have a clear diagnosis at that time, because some things kind of present slowly over time, or you may have one test that's a little off. I'm thinking about a patient who came to me with pain all over the muscles, not so much in the joints, but the muscles, his skin, just anywhere just hurt. And he had all these different tests that were okay, but was convinced that he had chronic tick disease, because the only time he felt better was when he was taking the antibiotic for tick disease. And that was a very complicated patient who had been jumping to different people and to different doctors. And I bet you're seeing some of those too, where it requires a long process to try to figure out what's going on. How do you approach that as a rheumatologist and communicate with doctors about that?
Yeah, so that is a very common kind of scenario where we will have to sort of watch someone over time to be able to figure out what it might be. I've often said to our students and our residents, if you can't live with uncertainty, don't go into rheumatology. So we're very comfortable with being able to say to someone, I think this could be in this category or it could be in that category, and we're just going to have to see what it is, what it's going to turn into. When we see people, we do try to make sure people haven't had some type of an infectious process that could be causing their arthritis. It's not all that common for those things to really, especially in North Carolina, although we definitely see Lyme disease and tick-related diseases in rheumatology, but not as common as, say, in the Northeast or something like that. And so we really our best diagnostic is taking a very, very good history from the person who's come to you, really talking to that person and getting a lot of detail about what the story is and examining them. And actually, sometimes you'll see that rheumatologists would actually order fewer tests than some of the tests that actually the person comes to us with a long sheet of tests that have been done already. because we kind of talk to the patient a lot. And I know a lot of doctors do that, but sometimes in very, very quick office visits, that may not get enough coverage. Mm-hmm. So, for example, we tend to focus a lot on whether someone's sleeping properly or not. Is their sleep disrupted? How is it disrupted? To get back to Adam's point about fibromyalgia and sleep disruption, that's a really important point when you're talking about chronic pain of almost any kind. And so those sorts of historical kinds of things that the patient can share with you can really be very, very helpful.
Well, you're talking Christy and I's language here. We're going to make you honorary family doctor by the time
right.
we're done. And maybe, I don't know if we'll ever be honorary rheumatologist, but we're going to need to take a short break. But when we return, we're going to continue talking with guest Dr. Joanne Jordan, Joseph Archie, eminent professor of medicine at University of North Carolina, about muscles, joints, aches, and related diseases, and some of the new research that's actually been coming out that's very exciting. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Joanne Jordan, Joseph P. Archie, Jr., eminent professor of medicine at the University of North Carolina, about muscles, joints, aches, and related diseases, as she is a rheumatologist. And I know that you've been involved in some ways with research about the rural South, and perhaps it has been hit harder than other areas by arthritis and disabilities related to that. And I wonder if you'd frame for us a little bit about what we know. Is that true?
So back almost 25 years ago, we were interested in knowing whether there was more arthritis in our rural areas in North Carolina. There had been some suggestions that, yes, people in rural areas had more arthritis than in other areas. And we designed the Johnston County Osteoarthritis Project to look in the population to see how common knee and hip osteoarthritis was, because that's the type that's most associated with disability. And we were also interested in looking at African Americans compared to whites, because there's really almost no data on that at all in 1990 when we began. We found out that, yes, arthritis was more common in both the knees and the hips than some other areas of the country. In some, particularly in the African-American women, some of that seemed to be explained by increased levels of obesity, which put the knees at particular risk. But we also were looking at other potential sorts of things that could be going on, like maybe some occupational factors that might put somebody at a higher risk of developing arthritis. And there probably are a few repetitive motion kinds of things that have been shown in several studies to be suggestive. We also looked at some dietary factors, and we looked at selenium in particular. And this kind of came from my trying to look around the globe and finding different types of arthritis that had similarities to osteoarthritis, the most common kind. And we looked at, actually, in China, There's a very terrible, really, arthritis that happens in children that isn't exactly like osteoarthritis, but is similar to it. And it's associated with having extremely low levels of selenium in the diet. And over the course of several generations, as this was first discovered and selenium was replaced in the diet of these children, the disease was going away.
Wow.
So here was an example of an environmental factor that was associated with an arthritis. And no one had ever really seen anything like that. And so we were interested to say, gee, I wonder if this has anything to do with what we would call garden variety osteoarthritis, the type we see here in the United States day in and day out. And in fact, some areas in the South have very low selenium in the soil. Huh. And we did see, we actually collected toenails from people and had them analyzed in a nuclear reactor in Missouri, and found that people who had lower levels of selenium in their toenails were more likely to have osteoarthritis. And so this sort of idea was kind of unheard of in a way, that we would be looking at environmental factors for osteoarthritis, really?
And how do you get selenium in your body?
Selenium, for the most, you get it in your diet. And so for most people in the United States, everybody has enough selenium, for the most part. If you were going to become deficient in selenium, you would probably have to be growing all your food in your own little part of the world and eating only that. So again, most people in the U.S. have adequate amounts of selenium.
So you're not encouraging our listeners out there to go get their selenium tested or to take selenium supplements necessarily.
We're absolutely not telling them to do that because it's not easily available. You know, in the ordinary doctor's office, we don't cut people's toenails and send them off for some strange analysis in Missouri. But selenium is also a tricky compound because if you take too much, and it's very easy to take too much, there's toxicity associated with it. And so although it was a very exciting finding because we were actually able to prove or show, you know, an association with an environmental factor that could be associated with arthritis, it wasn't something we could jump in there and tell everybody you needed to do this to change.
Before we get into some treatments that are being done that are really different, I wonder if you could also just speak to us for just a moment about you're a recognized national leader in genetics of arthritis. Help us understand, because I've got so many patients that come in to see me, and my mother, my father had really crippling arthritis. Am I going to get this? What do I tell them? What would you tell them?
Well, the genetics of osteoarthritis is very complicated. So it is not sort of a one gene kind of thing. So in contrast, if you say cystic fibrosis, we know there are multiple different mutations. But in general, you get this from both parents, and it's a clearly genetic disease. Osteoarthritis probably is caused by many different types of genes that not only interact with each other, but also interact with the environment. There are some variations around the globe as to which things are more associated with others. But you hit on one really important thing, Adam, which is when we see someone in the clinic, and this happens not infrequently, mom will be in getting evaluated, and she really is at the point of needing a knee replacement. Her knee arthritis is extremely bad. But her daughter is sitting in the chair, and the daughter is very, very, very overweight and is starting to have a little bit of knee pain herself. When you've got a parent with a joint replacement, and so even more important, I think, than collecting that family history about arthritis is the family history of a joint replacement. And that tends to be something that you can take to the bank as far as being something that you may be in trouble. And so what we try to do in that setting is we try to mitigate or improve the risk factors we can do something about, specifically avoiding injury, being physically active, and losing weight when you can.
Great.
And so for the patient and for the family, living with arthritis or with a chronic rheumatic disease, it could be, you know, all the ones that we've mentioned today, can be really scary, can be debilitating for them, can limit their ability to get around. What sort of resources are there for people to live with these kinds of problems long term in their life?
So this brings up a very exciting development that we've had at UNC at our Thurston Arthritis Research Center and the Osteoarthritis Action Alliance, which is really a large consortium that is funded by the CDC and had been administered by the Arthritis Foundation, has now moved to our unit at UNC, and Dr. Lee Callahan is managing this. This is a consortium that is really out there to educate the public and policymakers about ways to be dealing with arthritis, both to prevent it from if we can, as well as how you deal with it on a daily basis. So one of the things that we mentioned already is the importance of weight loss. We know from studies that have been done, and one that we're actually applying for, we're putting together a grant as we speak, we know that when people use weight loss in conjunction with exercise, they can get improvement in knee pain that can rival a lot of other medications.
Well, we're going to need to wrap up, but I almost feel like we need to invite you back already, because we got to talk about chondroitin, and we got to talk about diet, and we got to talk about nutraceuticals, and we got to talk about biologics that we said we were going to. So we may have to get you back on the show pretty soon, Dr.
That'd
Jordan.
That'd be great. I'd
too
be happy
much
to.
And too important a topic. We've been talking with Dr. Joanne Jordan, Joseph Piarchi, Professor of Medicine, Chief of the Division of Rheumatology, and Director of the Thurston Arthritis Research Center at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you very much.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have an issue you'd like Christy or I to address on an upcoming show, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our very first house call today about a yellow-tinged skin color.
My father is in his mid-80s, and I noticed when I visited him the other day that his skin had a yellow tint to it. I tried to research this online, but the only thing that kept finding was jaundice. He had a full workup with his primary about a month ago, and the test results came back normal. What could this be?
The most likely thing at that age is a myriad of things that can cause jaundice, which is that yellow tint that can come in the skin and from a lot of different kinds of medical problems. I wonder if a month ago when he got checked out from his doctor, maybe the doctor didn't check his liver or his bilirubin or any of the elements that might have picked up on that, or if this maybe developed since he saw the doctor.
All really good ideas, Christy. And, you know, on the flip side, if we just turn it around, maybe the doctor looked at these things and they're okay. And then that gets us into, you know, some of the other things that it could be. Probably less likely, but maybe eating too many carrots. You ever heard of anyone doing that?
You know, my son, who's now 6.5, when he was little, for the longest time, he would only have juice and nuts or fruit and nuts. And he ate so many carrots and so much carrot juice that he really honestly turned like this yellow-orange color.
Yeah, it's usually more orange than not. Sometimes when people have bruises, they can be a little yellow, or they have too much cholesterol in their blood can be a little yellow. No, I don't know. Sometimes, you know, there are colors that we don't fully understand, but I think checking the blood like you've done is the right thing to do.
Yeah, I would take him back to the doctor and say, this skin doesn't look right and
good
it's
idea.
Different than it used to be, and ask the doctor if he tested his liver and his bilirubin level and some of those things, maybe his thyroid or
thyroid's
his kidneys or
that's
other things
one, yes.
that could be involved.
Very good. Well, Erica, what's our very next house call?
I recently fell. I'm in my 50s and I'm a smoker. I was told I tore my medial meniscus. I was given pain medicine at first, but now no one will give it to me. Do I need surgery or can I take pain medicine?
That's a lot of questions.
That
there.
Is a lot of questions.
Well, we'll try to dissect that. First off, we're sorry you fell. Falling is painful. I think I do it about every day, once mm-hmm. or twice a day. But, you know, sometimes we start thinking, you know, if you fell and you hurt yourself, is there something else that could have caused that fall? You know, did you slip? Have you lost your balance? Do you have, you know, bones that are too thin?
And it may be that someone gave you pain medicine when you first fell because that was a big incident, obviously, and you were in a lot of pain, but that your doctor since that time has decided, or maybe with other medical problems you may have, that long-term pain medicines is not ideal for your situation. And that's a tough thing to negotiate between the doctor and the patient sometimes.
And tearing your meniscus can be painful. I did this a couple years ago, and it took 6-8 months for it to heal up, and I didn't have surgery. You could choose to have surgery. I was told by a very good orthopedist that I'll get to the same place probably both ways, you know, and so you can make those choices, and you could see a sports medicine doctor, get the knee injected or not. Lots of different options here. But probably, I would kind of agree, Christy. I'm not sure I'm giving pain medication, but I might give one or two more, or, you know, for a little bit if you really needed them, because, boy, that is painful.
I would encourage you again to have that conversation and to think about the other things you could do to try to make it better. If you can avoid being on those really strong pain medicines, the opioid or the narcotic pain medicines, if you can avoid it to not get hooked on them for the long term, then any other option is pretty much better.
Would you try acupuncture?
Oh, I would. There's very little harm in it and it might help. But
yeah. So we are kind of like-minded. We would probably try other things first.
Mm-hmm.
Well, good luck with that. And by the way, we want you to quit smoking because that reduces the blood flow to that knee. It makes you more likely to have thin bones, a lot of other host problems. And so good luck and quit smoking.
Let's take our next house call.
My daughter is going to college in the fall. I've always been an overprotective mom, but I just want the best for my child. What advice can you give to kids and their parents about going off to college and staying safe and healthy during this new transition?
Well, my daughter's heading off to college this fall, Christy, as you
probably
know.
Congratulations, yes.
Hallelujah, you know. But my wife went to orientation, and what she was told was, I think, some good advice.
What's
she
that?
They said, don't check in with your daughter every hour.
Well, that's good advice.
You know, just let them have some space. So that's one thing that I think we all could listen to hear.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of very specific health advice, I think you probably have some good ideas.
Well, I have some ideas. That process of letting go is tough, no matter where you are. But I would make sure that she's had all of her immunizations before going in the fall, especially her tetanus and pertussis and her meningitis. I would encourage her to make good friends and to try to limit to the extent that you can encourage her. But if I had her in my room, I would encourage her to limit drinking and risky behavior.
Those are good choices. Good friends and good choices.
Safe sex.
Yeah.
Or
being in safe relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of things can happen, particularly under the influence of substances that, including legal and illegal substances.
And I would encourage her to make those good friends and to stick with those friends, especially at night, not to walk by herself.
We'd agree with all those things. Good luck, and thank you for that question. Erica, what's our very last house call?
My mother is 85 and has diabetes. Her blood sugar is really high. Her doctor is working on increasing her insulin to get her numbers down. She doesn't feel sick, but she complains of being more tired than usual. Could this be coming from her blood sugar?
Sure. Having a really high blood sugar can make a person feel tired or feel sort of blah. Unfortunately, a lot of other things at age 85 and really any age can make you feel tired. So it may be more complicated than that. What do you think, Adam?
Well, I wouldn't take anything for granted. I think, you know, as people get up in their age, in their 80s and 90s now, we're seeing a lot of folks. I think when you have a new symptom, we should take it seriously and look into it, because both physical problems that could cause fatigue and psychological problems, and something like anemia from iron, lack of iron in your diet, or from other more serious problems could happen and be fatigued. And boy, we would hate to just chalk that up to the diabetes, which alone could do that.
That is a really good point. So we do agree with the doctor working on adjusting the insulin to get that sugar down, but you might also ask to sort of broaden the ideas in the testing to see what could be making her so tired.
I think Christy and I also would want to know, could we get you off the insulin rather than going up on the insulin, which could cause you to have low blood sugars, which could cause fatigue. You got that hypoglycemia. Maybe we could work with your doctor and you, and if you're overweight, we could work on reducing the weight even at that age. We talked a lot about sedentary lifestyles.
By losing weight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And maybe get down on the insulin. Who knows? We could try.
Yeah.
Wouldn't hurt.
Yeah, don't stop the insulin, though, without working with your doctor on that one. But thank you for the question, and thanks for all the questions. We've had some great ones today. We've talked about jaundice and yellow skin.
About going off to college and finding your space, but also finding a safe space.
About having an injury and the balance of pain medicines and other treatments.
Yep, and any of our listeners out there have questions they would like to send to us, Christy, they can send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can also share with us Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app.
Yeah, if you want to get our health app, just search Your Health, one word, for a free download at the App Store.
We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Joanne Jordan. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.